and welcome to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. This is just the third episode of my new podcast with Spiked. We've had some brilliant guests, I'm sure you'll agree. If you've missed any of the previous episodes for whatever reason, then you can just go online, go to your service provider, go to Spotify or Stitcher or whatever the fuck it is you use, and you should be able to find them all there. And it's only going to get better, to be honest. I mean, I know I'm biased, but I'm pretty excited. I've got some great guests coming up, so why not subscribe? And then you won't miss an episode. Easy. So I had the great pleasure for this episode to talk to two fellow stand-up comedians, Simon Evans and Jeff Norcott. I'm a massive admirer of both of these acts. They're brilliant comics. They're also very politically insightful, so I thought it would be great to get them on. And particularly in the light of recent developments in the comedy industry, I'm thinking particularly of the incoming Director General of the BBC, Tim Davey, who has made the point that he wants greater diversity of opinion on the channel. And whether that's going to happen or not, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But it is quite interesting that whenever you hear people talk about right-wing comedians, either in the press or on social media, the names that come up tend to include Jeff and Simon, even myself. And, of course, this is largely a misnomer. And I thought it'd be quite good for three of us of this coterie to get together and chat about the implications of this. And it was a really fascinating conversation. And you'll know both of these comics, presumably. Simon Evans, he's been on Live at the Apollo, Michael McIntyre's Roadshow, Channel 4's Stand Up for the Week. He even managed to make the subject of economics funny in his BBC Radio 4 series, Simon Evans Goes to Market. And he's a regular on the News Quiz as well, so he's a ubiquitous presence on the comedy circuit. Jeff Norcott is also very well known. You've probably seen him on The MASH Report, which is the BBC's flagship political comedy show. And on that show, he often gets the opportunity to express the contrary view to the establishment line that the show generally takes. He's also been on Live at the Apollo, Mock the Week, Question Time. He's very prolific. He's had two live national tours, sellout runs at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Just a brilliant, brilliant man. So we got both of them on today, and we were talking about all of these issues, and you know what, I could blather on about this for hours, but frankly, I'd rather hear what they've got to say. So, without any further ado, this is Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle and Jeff Norcott and Simon Evans. Tim Davey, incoming Director General of the BBC, has said that he wants to diversify opinion on the BBC, and he's particularly targeted comedy. So I thought we should start there and talk about that, because both of you obviously have written about this for the national press and you've got your own take on this. Why don't we start with you, Simon? What's your sort of view on that?
Well, there's a lot of issues there. Firstly, there's a question whether Jeff and myself are right-wing, or any of the other people listed, like Leo Kearse and Andrew Lawrence and so on, are right-wing. What does that mean? We nowadays often talk about the political compass when we're online, although that can be a more difficult thing to talk about than it is to look at. The political compass, which allows you sort of two vectors of dispute between authoritarian and libertarian, and between, I suppose, broadly fiscal sort of left and right wing positions as to whether you think money should be redistributed. And I think we probably, you know, all the various right wing comedians might well occupy different points on that graph. And then there is the other question as to whether or not Tim Davey actually said any of this stuff in the first place, really, or whether it was chucked into just the waters anyway.
Jeff.
I mean, it was incredible the fuss that was made, because actually when you boiled it down, right, what he actually said was maybe there should be a bit more diversity of viewpoint on sort of topical comedy generally. And it's weird because I think the industry as a whole has sort of discussed this for years, and almost no one has said that this would be a bad thing. And then it became, you know, surprise, surprise, Twitter took it down an apocalyptic Armageddon route of left-wing comedy was going to be cancelled. But, yeah, I mean, I'm with Simon on a lot of things. I think that the labels are unfortunate, but I do think that there may be a way of getting to the next point, if you know what I mean. Like, hopefully, eventually, it will just go back to how it should be. But for now, these imperfect labels will help us get there.
Where do you two stand on this, insofar as how do you label yourselves? Insofar as I know, Jeff, you've done shows where you call yourself a conservative in the title of your show, for instance. And Simon, I think lots of people do perceive you to be a right-wing comic. I get told that I'm far right all the time. So, I mean, what does any of this stuff mean? Where do you place yourselves on all of this? And does it even matter?
I think probably what Jeff and I would probably share, and I think what Tim Davey, if I can refer to him as Tim, my old pal, was probably getting at, was not simply the traditional left and right wing disputes so much as a sort of the new breed, the wokeism, and I know wokery is a trying and exhausting and frustrating title in itself, you know, but it's the sense of being hectored on ever more extreme and ludicrously evolved definitions of racism and the idea that every, you know, everyone exists on a sort of complex matrix of power and oppression and so on, that kind of idea of politics, rather than the old fashioned, you know, well, I'd like to see a couple of pence on the pint, you know, and maybe invest in the infrastructure a bit, you know.
It's a good impression of me, Simon. I know you've been working on it. I hope you don't use my lines just generally, but I'm happy in this context for the podcast.
It's just back and forth.
I think that, you know, if you just simply think about it, right, if there's a panel show of like about seven people or five people, as it normally is, right, and they discuss Churchill and his legacy, I would imagine that you know, it's not exclusive that left-wing comics would challenge his legacy, but I'd imagine probably most would. So it'd just be a shame if there wasn't maybe one person, maybe 20% of the people or even less, who just had humour that came from the starting point that it was at the very least a slightly more nuanced legacy. Because then what happens is the general public can see themselves in the discussion, right? And it stops seeming like this weird world where I always think about it like Marmite. You know where Marmite is this binary thing? You know, you either love it or you hate it. But in comedy, people have a single, or certainly for a long time, they had a singular view of Marmite.
Yeah.
And that's not right.
The funny thing about Marmite is I suspect there's plenty of people going, yeah, it's all right. But Marmite decided that it would be a much more interesting proposition to go, we are such an extraordinary flavour that we divide, you know, humanity as never. I think the thing with Churchill was a lot of the people who were quite approving of the idea that you daub Churchill was a racist underneath his name on the plinth are the same people who would go on Instagram and say, if you can't handle me at my worst, you don't deserve me at my best. You know, I mean, if there was ever a guy who embodied that principle.
So I think there is a kind of consensus here. Like I felt so. Certainly when Tim Davie made his announcement, that really it wasn't about left and right. This was, like you say, Simon, it was a culture war issue, actually, which is not really about left and right. Because I consider that the woke, if you call them the woke, I know they don't like that word anymore, but if you call them that, they're not traditionally left wing in any serious sense. They don't care about class inequality or economic inequality or any of those issues. They're about the other forms of identity. So really, I think it's fair to say that you don't get many people on panel shows, you don't get many comedians on BBC mocking the woke movement. You don't really get that very much.
No, and that is peculiar because the one thing that does seem to be common to a lot of woke demands and ambitions and aspirations is that they would only be delivered under quite authoritarian government. You know, if you just let people be, then they will not all conform to your notions of wokery. They will try and demand rights of free association and so on, which, you know, tend to conflict with that. And obviously government has attempted to kind of, you know, walk a middle path with these things. But most of the woke demands, whatever else they are, and however much you might feel that their hopes for social justice might be in some respect justified or at least understandable, but that is the way they will be delivered. And that has traditionally been the enemy of comedy. Comedy is, generally speaking, spoken up for the individual and, you know, the little man, you know, Warren Mitchell and Alf Garnett, you know, that idea that I think probably the single funniest and most trenchant line I've ever heard in political comedy was Alf Garnett, who said in about 1974, I've lived through 14 different prime ministers and I've been poor under every bleeding one of them. And that's as much as most people need to know about party politics, you know, but it's that kind of cynicism, perhaps, which is lost in the current kind of hysteria.
Well, there's also the issue you talk about authoritarianism, Simon, is that right now, right, my whole life, I was told these hard right Tories, they love authority, they love telling people what to do, right? That was the default position for so long. And here we are, right? We've got Tories that seem to be quite happily telling people what to do. And because for some reason, lockdown has become synonymous with a progressive position. Like, you know, it seems laughable that 2 weeks ago they were saying all a right-wing comic would want to do was praise the government. And here I am for the last, I've got so many issues with this conservative government. I don't understand why the left generally, and this isn't just comedy, why there's not some sort of like concern, at least, about the fact that fairly sweeping measures being introduced without any reference to Parliament at all.
Well, isn't it the case, though, that a lot of people have an idea of what right-wing comics are, and their idea of that is basically Bernard Manning, isn't it? That seemed to be what was coming out when people were going mad about this on Twitter.
Yeah, Jim Davidson,
40 years out of date, these comics that actually don't exist.
But he wasn't political either. That's what's so odd. He was. So what they're saying is he was hateful and bigoted and probably voted conservative, right? But that isn't being political in a way, you know,
right.
Like in the same way that whole circuit at that time is characterized that way, it's not true. A lot of them in the Dickie Bow generation were very playful performers, you know, and they weren't political in any sense. All they really mean is, I'm going to try and equate you with the most damaging person
Yeah.
In terms of what you want to achieve in comedy.
It's interesting that. I think you're absolutely right. And in the original piece I wrote for The Spectator, I think it was, there was a bit I had to cut out, but basically I said, you know, when you're talking about Jim Davison or Bernard Manning, those people aren't right wing. What they are is dated. You know, those ideas are just dated. Mm. They're outdated now. And a lot of the topics, yes, some of the jokes were racist and now they're about racism, but they're often the same joke. You know, they're just flipped over so that you laugh at the other end of the equation. But a lot of that stuff was like about mothers-in-law came because people lived with their mother-in-law, you know. And that doesn't happen anymore. So that we've moved on from that, you know, and a lot of jokes were about traffic cops. Well, there aren't traffic cops anymore. They're just robots that flash at you as you go past them, you know.
Yeah, life was really boring and one-dimensional. And there wasn't many subjects, you know, like when cheese came in plastic film that was really difficult to get off, of course Jasper Carrot is going to absolutely destroy it with a routine on that sort of cheese because there wasn't many cheeses. No. Like, it's really unintellectual to not apply context. I mean, the mother-in-law thing, it's so devoid of context, is that people, because of the economic position, suddenly a lot of people have found that they had to live with family again. Yeah. You know, they've got no phones to lose themselves into. Do you know what I mean? They've got no earbuds that they can go and have a walk. They've got this person who probably has some quite solid opinions on how they should live their life right in their face all day long.
We used to have a world where people used to have to sleep in a barn, you know, and choose which one of the farmer's daughters that they would share it with.
I think times change. I think even some of the comics that we've been talking about change. I mean, I saw Jim Davidson do his show at Edinburgh Fringe. That must have been what now, about 8 years ago. It wasn't about politics. It was about his horrible experiences of being falsely accused and going through that whole process. And actually, it felt quite contemporary. It didn't feel like a dated comic. It was a very good show. And this was an interesting thing to me because he's been so demonized. Yeah. And yet he himself said he wouldn't do Chalky anymore. You know, he said that infinite number of times, but it's like people's mindset is stuck in this time, this thing in the past. And then you have people like Owen Jones saying, well, right-wing comedy doesn't exist because right-wing people cannot be funny. They're just not funny. It's a market issue.
Mm. That's the weird stuff, isn't it? When they come out with absolutely sort of dictatorial, definitional sort of impossibilities, you know, as if it's like sort of going as matter and antimatter, you know.
That's it, but that was like, it's so the opposite of the values of the left is to suppose that specific human beings are incapable of innate qualities. That was the, like when I was growing up, that was the opposite. That was the last thing that you were supposed to think. And, you know, there's a point that I said in the Telegraph article I did, is when people say they're not naturally funny, they only talk about the same subjects and there's no market for it. That was exactly what they said about women.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Before, that's right.
And I think that the increase of women on panel shows really improved them, because it's true. Like, if you watch a Mock the Week from 2005, it does look bad, you know. And I'm the last person in the world to kind of worry about quotas, but when you see like blokes within the age range of, you know, like within 4 years of each other, all talk about mostly the same thing, it's not great. Yeah. And I think that diversity has helped, so why wouldn't more diversity of opinion help? I don't understand their point.
Yeah. Where do you stand, Jeff? Because I alluded to your shows. I know you did a show called Conservative, I think, in Edinburgh.
Very creative title, that, mate. W in there.
and your other show, you had another show that alluded to your Tory leanings.
Right-leaning but well-meaning. Well, that was slightly different. That was how somebody described me.
Right, okay.
In a coffee shop to someone else, because someone's like, oh, he's conservative. And then they balked at that. Like, oh, I'm not going to see him. Oh, no, he's right-leaning, but well-meaning. I thought this was funny. And then I got stick from loads of conservatives for years afterwards because I was sort of being a political Uncle Tom, and then no one actually listened to the show and realised that was the point. I thought it was a funny phrase for that reason.
So were they deliberately political show? Because I've seen you do lots of stand-up, which is not political at all.
Political is a small P broadly. So any hour that I spend on stage, probably 20 minutes will be about politics, you know, Westminster politics. 20 minutes will be about social politics. And then probably 20 minutes will be observational stuff, which is just fun stuff that comes out of the other two things. I mean, like the idea that, and that's been true of anyone that called themselves a political comic ever. I don't think that any of the greats would have dared to just spend 1.5 hours doing jokes about Westminster politics. An audience wouldn't tolerate it.
Yeah. And how do you feel about that, Simon? How much do you direct towards Westminster in your act?
I don't think I've done a show with more than 2 or 3 minutes of Westminster politics in it. And even then it would normally be, you know, the bit of Brexit material that I've done most is probably about the divide in my parents, you know, my father and my mother, and being irritated that my father's leave attitudes were dismissed as being an artifact of his lack of education and so on, you know, and this kind of thing. because he's a 90-year-old man who left school in 1944, and it wasn't a given then that if you could stand up straight, not piss your trousers for 3 minutes in a row, you were granted the opportunity to read media studies at Dunstable Polytechnic and lose 50 grand in debt and less employable than you were when you went in, you know. So it's a defence, really, of old people's right to have political opinions based on a lifetime's experience rather than what they've just been exposed to in a three-year education programme. So that's kind of where I go to. I really don't do political stuff at all, but I suppose to the extent that people might think that I'm right-wing, I mean, I have said some right-wing things on the news quiz and so on when it comes up, but when I think it's partly just the degree to which, by and large, I find comedy in the degree to which we make our own trouble and we make rods for our own back rather than blaming the government for stuff. I don't find that funny. That's what I think is odd about the idea that, you know, right-wing people can't be funny. Comedy is fundamentally a right-wing proposition because it's, you know, it's pessimistic. It says, you know, the world is full of gremlins, you know, it will get you, you know, we will make mistakes. It's like, you know, any time that you try and create some sort of collectivist fortification around yourself to prevent, you know, the hardships and the tribulations of life affecting you, that's a left-wing proposition, but it's not funny. That's like, is it like as funny as insurance?
I think that, you know, it is quite a small C conservative mindset is to accept the world as it is, not as you wish it to be. And that is the engine room of observational comedy. You go, well, this is shit. Let's have a laugh about it. There's nothing really funny in idealism. So, but what that eventually leads to is a sort of acceptance of stereotypes to a degree. And maybe this is where there is a path there where you could get into some tricky areas. But, you know, I am willing to say, you know, at the moment, I suppose a lot of comedy when it comes to gender will talk about exceptions, right? But I'm happy to talk about a rule, if you know what I mean. So, you know, I've been doing this routine about in swimming pools, you know, people say that gender doesn't exist, but I've never seen two men swimming side by side just so they could continue chatting, right? Now, that generally gets a pretty comprehensive reaction. And it would only do that if it was true to almost everyone in the room. It's not to say that every single woman does that. I think that the observation that I've never seen two men do that is absolutely secure.
There is always that degree to which who's saying it makes a difference. I remember, you know, Junior Simpson, who I haven't seen for a while, but Junior Simpson, a very funny black comic, and he had probably his signature routine for years, but this was some time ago, as you'll realise, for years, was that you would never get a black Formula One driver because he would be distracted by fiddling about with his stereo. And so, and then he would do the, you know, and he'd do a great thing using the microphone. And this was, of course, before Lewis Hamilton came along and has been like the world's number one. But there was enough of a, like a, yeah, people go, yeah, that's probably, you know, there would be, because he was a black comic, he could tell that joke. And because it was an observable reality that there were no black Formula One drivers, it felt like it was fair game, you know. And then, you know, suddenly there is one and you go, oh, well, I guess that wasn't true then, you know.
This is something I wanted to ask actually about this idea of I've noticed this over the past few years, and I just wanted to pick your brains and whether you've noticed it as well, is there has been a sort of escalation of people, certainly audience members, taking comedy at face value or taking things literally. I mean, you mentioned the joke about swimming side by side, and it's possible that someone could take that literally and think that you're making a you know, I mean, I get this quite a lot, and I get this sense that this is happening in society more broadly in terms of even like the surrender bill. When that was talked about in Parliament, people were saying that that was the kind of language that promotes violence. Well, it's not, it's just a metaphor, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I know what you mean, like whether audiences are taking offense. I mean, probably a better example with me is when I did Live at the Apollo. I had a routine. It was 7 minutes in the edit, but there was stuff about disabled people. There was stuff about concentration camps. But the bit that I got most flack for online was that I had a routine that involved the assertion that my wife likes shoes, right? And then people were sort of saying, it's just this lazy assertion that my wife likes shoes. I said, well, maybe she's lazy in her preferences for clothes. Like maybe like she's cliched and I'm not, you know what I mean? Basically, what I think what happened was that they watched me and they thought, I don't like this prick. You know what I mean? Which is fair enough. It's like, I don't think he's funny. And then they're on the alert. So what falls in your drop zone, you know? And I'd rather them just go, because I can handle it, is I think you're a bit smug and a bit of a git. And I think you're unfunny. Feeling like you need to take some specific thing. Because what I suppose there's an ego that comes from social media. It's not just that they can think it is, I need to now win other people over to this. I need to perhaps start a movement that creates problems for him. You know, it has to be more than just a simple aversion to a joke.
But that's quite an interesting point, that if you don't find a comedy routine funny, if there is no humour in it for you as an individual, then what else is there in that routine other than to sit there and pick it apart and take the words literally and think about what the comedian is trying to say and all of those kind of things? So you end up in a forced position of analysis. You end up being an analytical audience member because there's nothing there for you. Is that maybe a point? I don't know. What do you think, Simon?
Oh, I think it's definitely. I also think with comedy, I'm sure we've all three had this, it's extraordinary how strongly people feel about it when they don't like it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, anyone, you know, I listen to like Adele, I go, no, it's all right. Doesn't it infuriate me that she sold 5 million records? You know, I'm not like screaming, yeah, can you not hear?
Why is that? Why do people get so angry at comedy they don't like? I mean, most of the vitriol I get are people who are angry about the jokes I've told. It's weird. Yeah. It's a weird thing to get upset about.
Well, because it's a risk. It's a gamble. It's something they probably a lot of people would like to do. So when you fail at it, they vicariously experience what it would be like to fail, and it makes them scared. So then they have to produce. Yeah, sorry, I thought about this a lot. They have to then project that anger back onto you for how that made them feel.
That might be some truth to that. I do think a lot of why we even get away with doing comedy in the first place is because people are just thinking, thank God that's not me out there. And the first few minutes of any comedian is a lot of it is the tightrope as much as anything else. You're just going, sure. he's still up, you know, and then you relax and enjoy it, you know. I think there is something to that.
But this is the thing about comedians as well, is that there's this perception that comedians want to be loved. It's something you said in your article, I think, Simon, about how, did you describe them as borderline sociopaths? I think that's what you were saying. That actually, they will probably...
to a degree, but yeah.
Yeah, sure. But they'll probably go along with whatever the fashion... But maybe that's why so few are sort of taking on the woke crowd, is because they're in fashion at the moment. They're also in power, and therefore it's a bit more... Potentially, I don't know, but is that maybe what it is?
What's weird for me is that I have always had a lifelong desperate need to be liked. It's, you know, it's something that was around way into my mid-30s and stuff.
Right.
So doing the comedy that I've done is that ironic thing of the biggest risk, or seemingly, certainly in the first phase of it, was of not being liked. You know, like it was seen, certainly when I first started talking about these things, it was a guaranteed way to lose the room. I was always thinking it was a guaranteed way to lose a bit of the room, right? Not all of the room. So that's one. It's just a personal thing for me. Is when I started comedy, I was all like, I was very risk averse. You know what I mean? I did impressions of Gollum. When you did impressions of Gollum, I did drug. You know, I just loved being up there and everyone appreciating what I was doing. And then so sort of flipping to doing these shows where literally I was getting stared out in Edinburgh, you know, for long periods at a time was that it was just more. It sounds a bit wanky, but it's more of a personal journey. Like, can I do this? Can I stay up here? And in the first phase of it, I used to bail quite a lot. I used to think, oh, I don't like this. And then I would sort of start mocking the Tories back a little bit just to try and gain, you know, like really cozying up to whatever lefty crowd we're in. And that was desperate and unfortunate. You know, and I was almost blush when I think of doing that. But now I'm much happier to be unpopular for a little while.
I know what you mean. I did an Edinburgh show just after the Brexit vote, and I rewrote the whole show. So it was about, I was doing a pro Brexit show at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And I used to literally gauge the audience and see, and there were no sort of people who were pro Brexit at this arts festival. That wasn't going to happen. And there were moments in the show where I could feel myself losing them because they just didn't approve of what I was saying. Yeah. And then I'd go into quite shamefully, some old club material that would get them back on side. There's this sense of buoyancy that, oh God, I've got to stay afloat. Within this, but isn't there something quite exciting about when the audience turns on you, or when there's a division? I think of someone like Scott Capurro. When the audience stop laughing, he gets off on it. He tells me that, like, he enjoys the fact that he's caused tension.
People talk about risky comics. I hardly know any, really.
Yeah,
I think that he is someone that is willing to take it there, like genuinely.
Absolutely. Yes,
I totally agree. You're listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. If you're enjoying the podcast, please make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can subscribe to the podcast on all the major apps, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. And if your provider allows you to, then why not give Culture Wars a rating and a review while you're there? It would really help other listeners to find us. Now, back to the show. What do you think is going to happen now? What do we do in a post-COVID world? What happens to comedy, do you think?
In terms of the festival, so this year, I had a weird thing. Like, loads of comedians were saying, like, oh, thank God, you know, at least one good thing of COVID is we're not going to the Fringe. And I was annoyingly forced to acknowledge that I really do quite love the Fringe. And because it's a liberal sort of wanky circle jerk, I don't want to feel that way, but I do feel that way. I think it is a brilliant thing. Anyone that's ever known has gone there has enjoyed it. However, I did five, I called them front room fringes from home, a little bit of light in a backdrop. And I made more money in that run of five shows than I had done when I'd done a whole month of sold out shows, like more or less every ticket gone. And I think that is going to lead a lot of people. It's led me to wonder what my engagement with the festival will be going on. I'll probably never do like even a 2-week run again, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
That's impressive. I've got to say, Jeff, I'm really impressed that you've managed to do that, because I haven't set up anything. And my sense was that it would be very difficult to, you know, scale it, really. That I had two feelings, really. One would be that how would you market it? You know, there was obviously a huge marketing infrastructure, a brochure, posters everywhere. Mm-hmm. The city itself becomes a sort of crucible for performance in Edinburgh, you know, whereas if you're on your own, maybe you have a huge mailing list or whatever. But also my sense, this is, I suppose, the biggest barrier, is the sense that a lot of the value of going to see a fringe show, or indeed any stand-up comedy show, is the, you know, the communitarian spirit, you know, the sense that you're in a group of people who are all laughing at the same time, and that catharsis that comes from that, you know, it's wonderful, that kind of, you know, we are all one heaving with laughter. It's a very bonding experience, and it's hopefully it's triggered by good comedians better than it is by cheap, lazy comedians. But there is a degree to which just laughing in the company of other people is a great thing, you know. And I just wasn't sure how that could be achieved online. But if it can be achieved online, you know, then my God, I'm for it.
A bit of it can.
Yeah.
A bit of it can. I mean, the truth was, I'm quite basic. You know, I called the show conservative, right? So I call it Front Room Fringe, because I knew that in the month of August, if you could, because they haven't got like IP rights over the word fringe, right? Mm. It's got an alliteration in it, Front Room. I'm a very basic bloke, but I think it serves me well. But, you know, what it did was it made me write an hour and stuff. So I kind of think that the online market will still be there. I think a lot of people prophesized that once live came back, it would go away. But there's also a lot of people that have moved out of city centres that actually don't want to go in the cities. You know what I mean? They want to sit there with a glass of wine, have their favourite comedian on their telly. So I would probably do some sort of online run every August now.
Brilliant.
I'm really impressed by this, because I'm terrified the idea of performing to a virtual audience, no laughter. It's the atmosphere that worries me. That you, exactly what Simon's saying.
I've done a couple of corporates online, which somebody else set up, and they went really well. I was surprised. Okay. I was a bit nervous as well. I arranged very simple, straightforward elements to it, like making sure the laptop was so I could stand up, because I think if you're sitting down and doing it like a meeting, then you lose a little bit of the energy. But I set it up in a room where I could sort of dress properly, and there was a proper white backdrop and everything. And once I got going, I found it really actually quite energizing, you know. But of course, that would be my end of it. I don't know exactly, but you know, they seemed happy.
It is weird when you finish, and it's weird when you finish and then just go and stand in your corridor. That bit feels a bit sad.
Yeah, yeah.
I had it on my laptop. All I had was green screen. I had like a red brick background, bit of lighting. I had a mic stand, which I'm showing you now, which just helped me, like in terms of a prop. And then on my laptop, I could just click on people and speak to them if I wanted to. So I had like a front row dimension, which was like 20 to 30 people. And then, you know, a few hundred people watching around the back of that. So there was enough jeopardy there, but there's no doubt the bit afterwards feels fucking weird.
Does it change your performance style? Because I caught a short, you know, some of these comedy clubs are doing sort of online shows at the moment, and of course there's no laughter or anything, and I caught at the start of one of these shows, and I won't name names, but the MC, because there's something very performative and declamatory about MCs anyway, because they're trying to G up the energy in the room, and it just felt really weird, and it just didn't feel like, because I suppose what I'm trying to say is when we're on stage as standards, we don't talk the way we talk normally. And yet an online experience, surely, are you expected to bring it down a bit? You know,
stylistically, there was a difference. I think it'd probably be somewhere between three things, which would be a Zoom party where you're the main one talking, stand up, and a panel show performance. So it was it was somewhere between those three things. It wasn't straight stand up. You have to rein it in a little bit.
I think
the people a bit would find it weird if you was kind of grandstanding. And also there's the other thing from my point of view, is where I was doing it is where the neighbours could see me. like we didn't have any curtains. I just felt like a right prat. So every once in a while, I'd really bring the performance down just while someone was walking past with their dogs and they could just hear a bloke shouting. You know, probably think of poor Norcott, looking at that sad bastard. He had a little run on telly. Look at him now. He's just speaking to himself. Thinks he's still on telly, the poor fucker.
Just endlessly repeating it like in Sunset Boulevard. That's what you're watching your old shows. To what extent, though, do you think that when you're performing as a stand-up, you are yourself? I suppose I'm always interested in this idea of like, to what extent are you inhabiting a persona? Because I very much feel I do. And I will often be on stage and I'll say things that I absolutely don't believe. Or I'll do that thing I once heard Lars von Trier say, which is when he's making a film, he takes an indefensible position and tries to defend it. And I always find that quite a funny thing to do.
Yeah, with me, I suppose it's not. I mean, this is the thing as well, going back to right-wing things. People just say they detect some sort of persona and they go, ah, he's putting it on. It never occurs to them that all their favourite left-wing comics are doing the exact same thing. But with me, it's more a case of if I have a thought that is genuinely held, like the one I did on Mashaport a while ago was about that I think 80-year-olds should not have treatment on the NHS. It just occurred to me. I really thought it. I said it to my wife's grandfather. He laughed and agreed. And I thought, this is funny. You know what I mean? So I'm going to explore this more. Whether I would always think that is another issue. But I thought, oh, there's something in that. And then you try it for the first time. And then you sense that this has occurred to some people in the audience more. Like, you know, I think a lot of us have thought, well, really, what is the point once you get past 80? Really, everything's happened. All your mates have died. So then you get that complicity in the viewpoint. And mm-hmm. that's all it takes. So what it is, it's all you, but maybe it's a collection of a certain bit of you, if you know what I mean. It's a distilled version of this is all the kind of like, you know, like those kind of slightly knee-jerky reactions that I get where I think, no, I did think that, but it's funny that I think that too.
Are you saying that you exaggerate all your worst features? Is that
I think as I've gone on, I've certainly become closer to myself. So I'm probably a bit more conciliatory now. So I'll probably balance it out. But that's just because that's what I do in real life. Whereas maybe when I was trying to be a bit more shocking, I wouldn't have the nuance in it. Now I'll say, well, on the other hand, because that's what I do as a person.
You do feel very natural on stage. What about you, Simon? What do you think? How far away are you from the onstage Simon Evans?
I remember John Cleese saying many years ago that every comic adopts a persona on stage that is the person he is terrified of becoming.
That's nice.
Sort of exercises demons. I think Fawlty was his, you know, was the... pinnacle of that for him, but one thing that Jeff mentioned there, which does always enrage me, is the left wing trope that right wing comedians and right wing columnists in particular are just saying these things for money, that they can't possibly believe them.
Yeah,
these are preposterous, self evidently absurd opinions and takes and angles, and they're just things that opinions you have for money. Stuart Lee is always saying this about everyone from Jeremy Clarkson, Richard Littlejohn, and so on. And I'm sure, you know, Littlejohn does exaggerate. I mean, I don't read that stuff. That's the funny thing. The left seem to be far more obsessed with reading these things than I am. I never followed Katie Hopkins. I never followed any of these people who got banned on Twitter, you know, and people would always be going, oh my God, look what she said. I was like, well, how about not looking at what she said, you know?
Isn't that weird? It's a weird narcissism about this, that if someone expresses an opinion that you don't have, well, they must be lying because it's far removed from what I know to be the truth. It's weird.
Yeah, I suppose that maybe, I mean, there's some very, very clever people have written some very deep and elaborate books on this. There's a guy called Thomas Sowell, who's an American conservative thinker, who's written really well about a conflict of visions, as he calls it, between people who think that, you know, society is perfectible and other people who have seen what attempts to do that in the past have ended up with and would rather we didn't do that, you know, and just kind of try to keep an even keel. And I think there are people, genuinely, I honestly don't know whether Stuart Lee is one of them, but I think there are people who cannot see why you wouldn't want, you know, there to be equality, why you wouldn't want the goods and wealth and the riches of the world to be shared out evenly. How could you possibly not think that that would be a good idea? You know, because they have not, to my satisfaction, you know, investigated what has happened on previous occasions when people have promised that they intend to do that. That's why you don't want it to happen, you know, not because
it would be a nice thing
in principle.
I find it odd is that, you know, some people, they take exception to the emphasis being on individual responsibility, right? They take exception to broad scale tough love. When actually, if you look in their own personal lives and their own families, you'll always find examples of when they have used those things with people they know and love in the form of intervention. So they go, well, why couldn't that thing that you do at a localized level possibly work at a kind of macro level? And so there's a conflict in them as well between, I'm going to go off on it, but the liberal left, right, at least with the hard left, you sort of like, they had a position with Corbyn and you could argue with it. Liberal left to me increasingly just seems to be like, say a morally secure thing, like the centre left. And then you try and debate the difficulties and the paradoxes with changing things in terms of how you care about people or welfare. And all they do is keep repeating the secure moral position. And it's so, it's such a tricksy thing because at least with the, you know, during the Corbyn era, they had these tentpole policies that you could actually take apart. At the moment, it's literally boiled down to this is bad, I'm against this. And there's no attempt to grapple with the difficulties of making life better.
It's interesting what you say about families, Jeff. You probably both know the Robert Conquest's three laws of, you know, like the iron laws of politics. One of them is that everyone is conservative about that which he knows best. But the other one at the other end is every large institution, unless explicitly dedicated to right-wing ends, will tend to drift leftwards over the lifetime of its existence, which I think would be a perfect example. It would be the BBC of that, you know, but also possibly the United Nations or whatever. But you can talk about those two things as like the difference in scale. Just as you said, Jeff, what do we know best? Well, we know our family best. And every father will tend to be right-wing in his views about his children. You have to be a real lunatic, viz comic kind of, you know, modern parent to try and maintain any kind of Marxist or Platonic ideal about how to raise children, you know, without having some input on it and establishing some limits. But at scale, we forget all about that. At scale, we try and impose the tendency to become left-wing within an institution or an organization which has ambitions to affect society overwhelms it. It's quite interesting that. I think a lot about that, you know, like in the same way that we talk about, is it a right-wing, left-wing divide on the panel games when we first started with Tim Davis thing. I don't know that it's left or right. I think it's partly generational. I think there's a big generational divide. And I think a huge part of what's happening at the BBC lately, especially on Radio 4, in fact, although that's, I think, less in his crosshairs than the television output, is it's a generational anxiety. There is a panic, essentially, at Radio 4 that they are not bringing in young listeners, that they've got old listeners who are dying or can't even be bothered to switch on the radio anymore, and who, I don't know, who aren't opinion formers. Why it should bother them that, you know, if they still get 5 million listeners, for I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, why it should bother them that the median age is 53, you know, that's still a phenomenally successful show, and it's bringing a huge amount of pleasure to a huge number of people and probably justifies their license fee for a lot of them, you know. But they would much rather kind of screw down into the 18 to 25 demographic and somehow manage to bring them on board, and all they end up doing, of course, if they're not very careful, is alienating all those mid-50-something people who just feel sneered at and mocked and ridiculed. And the young people are still just going to go straight to YouTube and Snapchat for their content anyway. They don't care.
I think they're also probably misjudging a lot of the younger people. I think there's an assumption that young people are woke and that's actually not true. There's a lot of young people, and particularly Generation Z, that are really pushing back at this stuff. And you see that on various TikTok videos and that kind of thing. So I think they're probably getting that wrong, but.
Mm. Yeah, based on TikTok alone, I'm a big fan of Generation Z. I mean, it's all I know about Generation Z, but they're funny, man. I don't know what it is about how they package humour, but they've almost got a postmodern take on the last 15 years of social media, and it's hilarious, and it's far less morally pompous perhaps than what's come before it.
It's snarky as well, isn't it? There's a lot of zip in it. I agree. Yeah. Well, it may be the time. I mean, we may be reaching a point where there is going to be a massive overturn in terms of what the material, the medium is. You know, most people would agree that most great artistic movements only have 20 years in them max, usually. You know, you look at like rock and roll from 55 to 75, most of it had been done by 1975, hadn't it? And then you started getting revivals of one kind or thing, you know. And you can probably look at that with stand-up comedy. There has been that sense that, you know, we've kind of gone through, you know, I'm probably to some extent, you know, a combination of the tropes of my four or five favourite acts. And, you know, it's quite hard to do anything really devastating and new. But with Snapchat and TikTok or whatever, there's all kinds of opportunities to be creative in a new way. And that always enlivens the actual material.
Hi, it's Fraser Myers here from Spiked. I produce Culture Wars along with all of Spiked's other podcasts. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I know it's early days, but if you think this might be a show that's worth supporting, then the best way to do that is to make a donation to Spiked. Even something as little as £5 per month is hugely appreciated and can make an enormous difference to our work. Your donations help us to keep going and growing so we can keep providing you with new, exciting and ambitious content. If you'd like to make a donation, it's really easy. All you need to do is go to spiked-online.com and hit the donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and hit the donate button. Now, back to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle.
just to tie together a couple of things that you've both been talking about, is I'm detecting that there's a real sense of rigidity and on the left wing comedian's mindset. Like, this is the reason I don't like Edinburgh anymore, because last time I was there, I just noticed that comedians I'd known for years, because I've been expressing my opinions very publicly, just that they would literally shun me and walk away. They didn't want to be seen with me. It's quite an unempathetic.
Well, the thing is I actually am right wing, right centre, right, whatever you want to call it. But I was in the loft bar with you, and technically I should be more of an enemy. But when I sat with you, I was like, all right, here we go.
No, you're not. And yeah. I think it's, I don't know why that is. I think it's because I've mocked the woke thing so much, I guess. I don't. It's the Brexit thing, potentially. I think it's
because you're doing like satire. Satire is more of a threat, isn't it? People are scared by satire. Whereas, you know, I tend to do political comedy, small P political comedy. It's not as much of a threat. Whereas satire, I think it really has the potential to upend people a little bit. And that's why people get a bit more threatened by it.
Well, why are comedians of all people so homogeneous in their opinion? Why, do you know what I mean? Surely they should be the ones where we should have all sorts of discussion. They should want more discussion, not less. They shouldn't want to be throwing out these, as you said, Jeff, these sort of these moral certainties and not being willing to firstly entertain the possibility they might be wrong, but also just to discuss their views.
I think it's comedians at Edinburgh. If you think about like the club circuit, even going back 10 years, like the amount of comics that I can think of that would have all had anti-woke bits in their set here and there, because you couldn't survive, you know, with a mass audience without sort of covering quite a broad spectrum of viewpoints. So in a way, I'd maybe hesitate to say all comedians, but certainly within that kind of hothouse, you're much more likely to find people threatened by that.
There's a weird projection of hatred as well. Hate has become like one of the major buzzwords of the last few years that hasn't been probably investigated enough, I think. It's always from the left. Always the assertion is that, well, that's a magazine that hates trans people, or, you know, that's a joke that hates women. You know what I mean? It's like, there's no hatred there. It's just an observation. There's a bit of a laugh about how some people be, you know, some things are a bit incoherent or confusing or baffling in the model. But the hate, and it can only be, I mean, I know this is armchair Freud, but it can only be projection, can't it? Because, you know, if you're creating material which doesn't come from a place of hate at all, and in fact, if anything, is really rooted in your own bafflement as you try and navigate the complexities of the modern world, you know, and then you go, this is your material hates. And it's like, it's constant. It's become the most popular go-to frame for anything left-wing, is to present the alternative as rooted in and fundamentally, you know, driven by hate.
But you would think that comedians would know that's not true.
Yeah.
Because I can't think of a single comedian who's going out there to spread hate about racial groups or sexuality or anything like that. I couldn't name you one. They don't exist.
No, I mean, one thing that I want evidence of is that quite a few, you know, handful of colleagues, when this discussion all happened, were sort of talking about, you know, comedians potentially, you know, mocking the poor. I would just love one example, even just anything from the last 20 years of when any comic, left or right, has used somebody's poverty as a reason to get a way of getting a laugh, because I just don't think it exists. It's so ridiculous.
It's so basic. I mean, even David Mills used to have a brilliant routine about a homeless person. I think he was talking about setting up an alternative to The Big Issue. Or so. I can't remember the whole thing. But the point is that one review said that he was attacking homeless people. It's such a literal... This is what I was saying
you
about
literal
interpretations.
Like, audiences are... People are fair. That's a great thing. Is you get a group
audiences
of people
understand.
Together, they'll gravitate towards a morally fair point. So if you are out of order... And if you just properly punch down, I mean, I absolutely lever somebody in an unfortunate position, you're not going to get a laugh. There's no real laughter in someone just being poor.
That's my point. Someone as clever as David Mills is obviously not going up there to attack the poor. He's doing something a little bit more sophisticated than that. And you would think a critic of all people would understand that, but there aren't many good comedy critics, let's be honest about it. But that to me is very interesting, that kind of almost willful misinterpretation. I mean, I think what you're saying about hate is right. Like, even an act like Jerry Sadowitz, who is like this explosion of hate, but it's a performance of hate.
Yeah.
It's a theatrical representation of hate. It isn't as simple as just saying, oh, he hates everyone.
But it goes back to what we were saying earlier, which was about, like, if somebody just doesn't like you and they don't want you to succeed. Like, I had a review in 2017 where I told a story about a confrontation with a naked gay man in a swimming pool who was being discussed, and he spat a few people around the pool. And so I was thinking, like, I'm gonna have to call this guy out, he's being unreasonable. And then he pushed me, and then I realized in the pool that he was naked, right? So I thought, If I now have a fight with a naked gay man at a gay hotel in Ibiza, like, there's the potential for this to be construed as a hate crime. So I didn't have the fight with him now. The reviewer represented this as a hate crime, essentially, like I just attacked a naked gay man, which is kind of, like, weird in itself. But also left out the context, like, that both my son's godparents are two married gay men. So the level of willful misinterpretation there is, like, I do not want this person to succeed. I hate him as a comic and a stage presence. I also hate the politics he represents, to the point where I'm not just going to take something the wrong way. I'm actually going to go. This was a reasonable critic for the list. You two could both Google this afterwards. And any comment.
I think I know who it is.
Yeah. And she just went so far. And I was shocked by that moment. I was shocked. Like, she hated me. I hated my comedy. But I suppose one of the things, the only thing I can't handle is people misrepresenting what I've said. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
This again makes me wonder if it's intergenerational to some extent, because there would be an understandable desire on the young to reclaim and remake comedy in their own image, you know, and not to just inherit 30 or 40 years of, you know, I mean, you could say that's what Alexis Sale and Rick Mayall and whatever you were doing in the early 80s, you know. I think to my father and a lot of his generation, that seemed like just wanton, you know, ignorance and destruction, you know, and they couldn't understand what was so appealing about the young ones, you know, and we were all delighted by this anarchic trashing of everything that had come before, you know. There's an understandable impulse.
That makes sense to me, but what doesn't make sense is the moralistic stance that it is. To give you an example, so there was an article about Bill Hicks in The Guardian, and I think a number of young comics, and it went through them one by one, and they basically took turns to slate Bill Hicks and say his work was problematic and that it was basically hate and all the rest of it. And so it's not just we want to reinvent comedy, we want to do a new thing, something that's radical. It's a moralistic Mary Whitehouse style prudishness about former generation. That's what's weird to me.
Yeah.
You know, because that to me isn't radical.
Well, maybe that's what has to happen in response to what happened in 1980, I suppose. There's revolution and then counter-revolution, I suppose. Yes. I don't know.
There is a risk, I think, with, you know, whatever it's called, right of centre comedy or non-woke comedy, is I do see it online as well, like an emerging sort of smugness on my side of the argument too. So you can already see that as this backlash is happening, this kind of thing that woke people can't be fun. You know, it immediately runs the risk of perpetrating all the same crimes as before, because there is safety in numbers. The truth is, you know, the audience for these viewpoints is actually bigger than it is on social media.
I think that's quite interesting. Like, if you watch Netflix and certainly like the American circuit, you know, there are some very big hitters on the anti-woke side. Dave Chappelle and Bill Burr are probably the two obvious ones. Fantastic comedians, you know, really delivering the goods time and again and nailing it and analysing it and dismantling it and leaving it in ruins. I think to some extent we haven't quite found that. We haven't quite found that pace or that status yet with the rear guard.
But is that a British thing though? Because, like, you know, sometimes I hit my stride on stage and I think, here we go, you know, that swagger. And then because something about being British that, I've got swagger. It almost feels like I'm surfing a wave, right? And then you think, well, the only thing you could do once you're on a wave is fall off of it. That's quite British to think, well, bloody hell, I've managed to get on a wave somehow. Whereas I suppose a more American mindset is like, what a fucking great wave. I'm going to surf all the way to shore. So I agree. I mean, their confidence in what they're saying is enviable, isn't it? And I guess the point about the smugness is just that there's always that risk of overcorrection, isn't there? There was an overcorrection before. And I think there's certainly a duty with comics. It's just to think about, you know, it's not to self-censor, but for the joke to work, to think, are the targets fair targets, you know, to you?
But I think comedians do that anyway, don't they? I mean, comedians do assess whether what they're saying is fair, and do they? Or maybe am I just being idealistic?
Well, no, I mean, just if you want the joke to have the best chance of working, right. I guess, you know, it's not a moral sort of, it's more of a professional, technical necessity.
Is there something to be said for the fact that the ones that Simon's just identified, like Dave Chappelle, the people who have a go at woke culture tend to be very established, very rich. They're in an uncancellable position. And I think one of the issues that the announcement by Tim Davey raised is actually, can you change the BBC? Because I think the BBC is systemically woke. I think it's built into it now to such an extent. That's why I don't think young people are mocking this, because they know that their card will be marked if they do. And that's That's a problem.
I think it would be a problem, to be honest, if you just said, right, in the same way that you did with female comics, we now have to have one right-wing comic on every episode of Mock the Week. I think they would really struggle to integrate. Mm. I think they would be, you know, it would be obvious that they'd been put there on some sort of quota basis. It leaked out that they did that with women, and it was destructive to the respect in which you could automate, yeah. You know, the women overcame that and it flourished eventually. But I think, for instance, and I'm not saying he will do this, but if he were to say, listen, I want you to commission for every show that you commission, like the MASH Report, I want there also to be one which just appeals to the sensibilities of the 50-year-old middle-aged middle-class license payer. I just want to see something that reflects their ideas rather than this student politics. I think then you would probably get independent production companies falling over themselves to create such content. And I think, you know, that would probably work. I just think there's absolutely no reason at all why that shouldn't work.
Well, did you see that news about this new Rupert Murdoch news network and the idea that they're going to have a nightly comedy show? And I just saw there'll be so many comedians that discover their libertarian streak overnight. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? If there's someone been paying above the market rate. I tell you, because, you know, I mean, we've had it before when RT, Russia Today, did like a weekly comedy show. I was on that show. You know, I mean, I'm transparent about it. But there's a lot of lefty people went on that show too. I think it would be potentially good if that show happens, because competition is healthy. Do you know what I mean? At the moment, it's a one-trick thing, and it might force other channels to sort of shit or get off the pot.
Very well put.
You'll find that maybe all comedians are right-wing deep down. Listen, thanks both for coming on the show. Can you tell us where the listeners can find you, or if you've got anything coming up that you want to plug?
Well, I do believe they've managed to rescue one tour date from my otherwise postponed autumn schedule, and that's at the Stand Comedy Club in Newcastle. And hopefully, you know, that might be a model which other venues can deliver on. I've been trying to say to the people, I will do three shows in one night if that's what it takes to overcome the social distancing thing. But of course, the trouble is, if the theatre is otherwise only putting on productions which have 20 or 30 people in, you know, it can't just reopen from scratch in order to put a stand-up comic on and then put the dust sheets down again when I leave. So,
yeah.
I mean, that is a problem that we had. My end is that we tried to get tour shows away this year, but if all the other comics have moved all of their shows to next year, and in fairness, a lot of these comics got much bigger shows than me, right? So they're sort of scaling down from 3,000 to 700 is a much bigger thing of me scaling down from 500 to 150. But yeah, we're getting a few away.
Yeah.
I will be in touch with Jeff on private channel to find out the model for the front room fringe.
it's conservative. We're the ones getting out there with the blitz spirit, making shows happen. So I've got my podcast, What Most People Think, and I will be back out on tour. There's a couple of dates with tickets available this year. There's also a couple of new dates, October the 17th, Newcastle, then October the 18th, Birmingham. And the Newcastle one, same as Simon, is the great thing about it is the Stand is a brilliant club. It is in trouble. So even if you hate us, right, you can do the left-wing thing and go, I'm actually saving the venue. So just buy the ticket. You don't even have to come.
That helped the social distancing. Actually, I think the Newcastle venue is probably a good one to social distance, because it's quite broad, and I think it'll work in there.
Yeah, it is. Right. It's a good size room, compared to the size of the audience I can usually pull in Newcastle. Yes.
I think I've done gigs in that room which are socially distanced, just because everyone's sat apart and there was no fucker there, you know. Thanks both. Really nice to chat to you.
And you, Andrew. Take care. See you, Jeff.
Thanks a lot. You've been listening to Culture Wars with me, Andrew Doyle. Make sure that you subscribe to the podcast so you never miss any future episodes. You can follow my every move on Twitter, because I'm desperate for attention, and you can read my articles on www.spiked-online.com. Oh, and Titania McGrath has got a new book out. It's called My First Little Book of Intersectional Activism, so why not go and buy that as well? Until next time, farewell.